Starting at the very beginning, Sugar's entry into this world is well, it's pretty bleak. She's taken from wherever she was as a baby, and the only reason she's considered valuable at all is because she's fat.
Yeah, it's totally pragmatic. In this society, a fat baby equals potential.
It's kind of chilling, to be honest. And like a lot of the kids in this system, Sugar has no memory of her life before the COP.
Yeah, it's like a clean slate, but not in a good way. More like a blank page that they get to write on.
Her earliest memories are just, gray walls, steel cribs, that kind of thing. She even describes it as rows and rows of other children who had no names.
Right. So from the very beginning, she's stripped of any individual identity. It's dehumanizing, really.
Yeah, she's not seen as a person, just as a unit of potential. And this really sets the stage for how she navigates the rest of her life. Then around age 3 or 4, she enters the Canis Optimization Program, the COP, as they call it.
Right, and that's where the idea of viable becomes her entire world.
Viable meaning useful, meaning you won't be discarded.
Exactly. And it's at that point that she gets her name, Sugar.
Which was originally meant as an insult, of course, because of her weight, but it stuck.
I mean, it's pretty ironic, right?
Totally. No last name, no history, just Sugar. And here's where things get really interesting. Because while most of the kids in the COP kind of just go along with the program, Sugar becomes, well, she becomes almost obsessed with Cainism.
Yeah, she's described as a total fangirl.
She, like, devours the lectures, memorizes all the texts. It's not just obedience. It's like religious devotion.
It's fascinating, right? Like, why embrace the very system that's oppressing you?
Well, maybe it's about control. Like,
Yeah.
in a world where she has absolutely no control over anything, Cainism gives her some sort of framework, some sort of rules to live by.
Yeah, maybe it's a way of finding meaning in a meaningless situation.
But here's the catch. She's still fat.
Right, which is a major liability in a system that values efficiency above all else.
So she has to compensate. She knows she has to be, as she puts it, smarter, meaner, and louder than everyone else.
It's like she's weaponizing her personality to make up for her perceived physical flaw.
And then, of course, we have the classic rival dynamic. Enter Vess. Vess is everything Sugar is not. Tall, lean, basically the poster child for Cainist ideals.
Yeah, Vess represents the system's idea of perfection. She's naturally gifted, effortlessly efficient.
And of course, she hates Sugar's guts. Right from the start, there's this tension, this unspoken animosity. You see it in the little things, the muttered insults, the sneers, even a deliberate trip in the hallway.
It's all about establishing dominance, right? Showing who's superior.
But Sugar doesn't back down. She gives as good as she gets, using her wit and her pretty sharp tongue to deflect Vess's attacks.
It's like a verbal sparring match, and Sugar's pretty good at it.
There's this one exchange where Vess basically tells Sugar she's wasting space, and Sugar just shrugs it off and calls Vess Cainism light.
Yeah, it shows you right there how different their worldviews are.
Then things escalate when Vess officially challenges Sugar to a Cainist duel.
It's all very formal, done through these challenge slates.
The slate reads, Arena selection, Vess versus Sugar, judgment, strategy plus endurance.
So right away, you think it's going to be a battle of wits, a mental challenge.
Sugar definitely thinks so.
But then they reveal the arena, a giant tank of water.
And Sugar is terrified of water. It's a deep-seated fear, a real phobia. The challenge is simple: tread water the longest. But Sugar can't even touch the bottom and she starts to panic.
I mean, it's a nightmare scenario for her.
And in a moment of pure terror, she throws up right there in the water.
It's a disaster, a total
It
mess.
also ends the challenge. They have to stop it because of the, because of the unsanitary conditions.
Sugar technically wins.
By default.
Not exactly how she imagined it, but a win's a win.
The Cainist court, of course, ends up nullifying the challenge because of the whole vomiting incident. But Sugar does get some recognition for enduring in her own way.
Which leads to a rematch.
Sugar's immediate thought is, please, not a food challenge. Which leads to this whole aside about pre-Cainist eating contests.
It's pretty bizarre, actually. They talk about these massive events where people would just stuff themselves with hundreds of pies, huge cakes, all this crazy stuff.
Just for fun, for
It's
entertainment.
so different from the world Sugar lives in, where everything has to be efficient, practical.
Talk about a culture clash.
Right.
So, rematch is on, and Sugar knows she has to change her strategy. She decides to go for psychological warfare. her main tactic, making Vess relive the humiliation of the water challenge, she starts casually mentioning to everyone how Vess was swimming in her lunch.
It's brutal, but effective.
We also see Sugar interacting with her doormate, Mouse. Mouse is, she's kind of an outsider too, and she seems to tolerate Sugar, mostly because she likes to piss people off. Then there's Kevin, who just loves the drama.
Mouse and Kevin represent different ways of surviving within the COP. One's defiant, the other thrives on chaos.
And then Sugar overhears something that really changes the game. She hears some instructors talking about Vess's parents. They're making special requests for Vess's training, which is unheard of in the COP.
It's a huge revelation. It means Vess has connections, influence.
Something Sugar doesn't have, and she realizes that this isn't just a personal rivalry anymore. It's about survival. She has to win, or she might get crushed.
The stakes just got a lot higher.
Which leads to that incredible scene in the dining hall. Vess is there with her parents, and Sugar just waltzes right up to them. It's awkward, it's tense, and then she starts messing with them about her name.
That whole Sugar, what dear thing, is brilliant.
She's being deliberately provocative, and it culminates with her announcing her full name, Sugar Cane.
The whole room erupts. People are laughing, Vess is furious, and
Cana's scouts are watching.
It's a masterstroke. She's made herself unforgettable.
The fallout is immediate. Everyone's talking about Sugarcane. Vess is out for blood.
But Sugar's not scared.
Even Mouse and Kevin are worried about the consequences. But Sugar knows that the scouts are paying attention, and that's all that matters to her.
She's playing a dangerous game, but she's playing it her way.
And then they announce the final challenge. No details, just that it'll be a true test of Canist endurance.
Everyone's speculating, trying to figure out what it could be.
Mouse thinks it'll be some kind of brutal fight. Kevin thinks it might be public humiliation. The tension is thick.
It's psychological torture.
Then they reveal the challenge, the hold.
Basically, you have to hang from these pillars by your wrists, and the last one still hanging wins.
It's a military exercise designed to test pure endurance. And Sugar, with her build, is at a major disadvantage.
It seems like the Canist Council is trying to set her up for failure.
But Sugar never goes down without a fight. The pain is intense right from the start. Vess is holding on like it's nothing. Sugar, on the other hand, is trembling. Her muscles are burning. And then, out of nowhere, she farts. Loudly.
In the middle of this tense, silent standoff, it's hilarious.
Everyone bursts out laughing. Vess is disgusted. And through the pain, Sugar is grinning. It's like she's weaponizing her own body.
She's using humor to break the tension.
Yeah.
To gain a psychological edge.
But the challenge goes on. Her grip is slipping. Vess is still going strong. But Sugar focuses on the name Cane. She repeats it to herself like a mantra.
It's like she's drawing strength from the very symbol that others use to mock her.
And slowly, Vess starts to show signs of weakness.
For the first time, she's facing real adversity.
Sugar sees it, and she knows Vess has never really experienced failure before.
It's a crucial insight.
Sugar's internal monologue is amazing here. She thinks Cane never fell first, and she just keeps going, pushing through the pain.
It's pure willpower.
And then Vess's grip starts to falter, for real this time.
She's cracking.
A new wave of pain hits Sugar, and she does something totally unexpected. She starts climbing the chain.
She's breaking the rules.
But it's strategic. She's repositioning herself. And then, in a move that can only be described as genius, she lets out another massive fart.
Right in Vess's face.
The smell, the sound, it's too much for Vess. She loses her grip and falls.
Sugar wins.
Gasping for air, she looks down at Vess and says, "Cane wins." It's perfect. Mm-hmm. And that victory changes everything. She's immediately fast-tracked, pushed into all these crazy tests, IQ evaluations, pattern recognition, combat simulations. It's nonstop.
The Canis Council sees her potential now. Mm-hmm. They're throwing everything at her to see what she can handle.
And then comes the supermarket sweep.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they literally drop her in the middle of a supermarket robbery. No instructions, no backup. Just go.
How did that even qualify as a test?
I don't know, but Sugar handles it like a champ. Instead of, you know, trying to fight the robbers or whatever, she starts gathering snacks.
Tactical snacking, she calls it.
While the robbery's going on, she's talking to the robbers, making these bizarre, random comments.
Distracting them, basically.
And then she uses those snacks and a can of something to take them down. It's ridiculous. It's brilliant. And the whole time, Canis scouts are watching.
They're seeing her in action in a real-world situation, and she's exceeding all expectations.
The tests keep coming after that. The impossible choice, which she solves by smashing the tablet they give her.
Makes sense.
Then there's the maze, which she somehow navigates by talking and humming.
Maybe she triggered some kind of sensor.
Who knows? But then she gets to the street fight, and she loses.
Her first real loss.
It shows that her improvisational style doesn't always work. She can be reckless.
Which is a dangerous trait.
And that loss leads to a meeting with a canist psychologist. He's supposed to figure out what makes Sugar tick.
He's trying to analyze the unanalyzable.
His assessment is pretty spot on. Reckless, stubborn, relies on improvisation and charisma, both strengths and weaknesses.
He sees the danger in her unpredictability, but also the potential.
The whole evaluation is a back and forth. Sugar's using her humor as a defense mechanism, deflecting the psychologist's questions. He asks her about her belief in Cainism, and she just says, "I like winning."
Simple as that.
They talk about the street fight, how even though she lost, it got her VIP access. She avoids questions about her past. And when he asks about her name, why she chose Cain, she just says, "Because it's funny."
She's messing with him.
He asks if she's afraid of losing, and she says she has a fan base. She doesn't see him as a real therapist, just another Cainist evaluator.
She's still playing the game.
And then she throws down the gauntlet. Am I a survivor, a threat, or just your next little experiment? The psychologist's response is chilling. You're dangerous. The kind we can't quite predict yet.
It's a warning, but also a recognition of her unique power.
And Sugar is loving it. Then the psychologist says something really interesting. He says, Cainism doesn't account for everything. It's not a perfect system.
That's a crack in the facade. A glimpse behind the curtain.
For Sugar, it's a huge realization. The system isn't infallible. And then comes the aptitude evaluation. They hook her up to all these machines, biometric scans, the whole works.
Sounds intense.
And then they ask her to sing. Yeah, they say it's about breath control, projection, influence. Sound is power, they tell her. And Sugar just lets loose.
This sterile scientific environment.
She's singing at the top of her lungs, completely disrupting the whole test. They call security, but she doesn't stop. She keeps singing until they drag her out, kicking and screaming. And as they're taking her away, she's laughing and yelling, "You don't know what to do with me."
It's a total rebellion against the system, against their control.
And the lead examiner just watches, no expression, like he's seen it all. Right after that, they take her to the pool.
Water again.
Her biggest fear. A guard taunts her, and Sugar starts singing again, louder than ever, completely off key.
It's like she's using her voice as a weapon.
Then they blindfold her, blast heavy metal music through headphones, and throw her in the ocean.
At night.
It's no longer a test. It's a fight for survival.
They're pushing her to the absolute limit.
She manages to get the blindfold off, and she's surrounded by water. No land in sight. She uses the sound of the helicopter to get her bearings and spots a distant light. Croc Rock, a Cainist symbol.
A beacon in the darkness.
Then she gets a leg cramp. And worse, she sees sharks circling.
This is a nightmare.
And what does she do? She starts singing.
Again?
Yeah, but this time it's a low-dep whale song.
A whale song?
I know, it's crazy. But it works. It attracts an orca, which scares off the sharks.
An orca. A killer whale.
And the orca starts guiding her toward the shore.
That's incredible.
She keeps singing the whole way.
Even though she's probably terrified.
She ends up clinging to the orca's back, still singing, even though the orca clearly isn't thrilled about it. It keeps dunking her underwater.
Like, shut up already.
But she makes it to shore. Back at the academy, they don't even give her time to recover. They throw her into an art class, a creative aptitude test.
Art. For Sugar.
Her painting is awful. A five-eyed orca.
Sounds about right.
Then they give her a reading comprehension test, and she struggles. The letters are moving, making no sense.
That's interesting.
It is, because that's when the examiner tells her she's dyslexic.
Dyslexic.
Yeah, and it explains why she can read upside-down text more easily. Her reaction is amazing. She says, different is dangerous, and then I'm a super weapon.
She turns it into a positive.
Immediately. She accepts it, owns it. It's just another tool in her arsenal. And then, boom, they take her for another test.
What is it this time?
Pain endurance, psychological resilience, cognitive function under duress. They strap her to a chair, shock her with electricity, blast her with ice water, all while asking her to state her name.
That's torture.
It is. But she doesn't break. She sings through the pain. It's defiant. It's powerful.
Unbreakable.
After that, they lock her in a prison cell. She meets another inmate, all scarred up, and she deals with taunts from the other prisoners.
The prison test.
Whatever that means. And then the world ends. Yeah, literally. There are tremors, power outages, sirens. An emergency broadcast comes on, and it's chaos. A satellite, maybe a weapon, has broken up in orbit. Impacts, tsunamis, global destruction.
Came to you.
Sure seems like it. And the prison starts to flood.
Oh, no.
Total panic. Sugar tries to swim, but her fear gets the better of her. Her cellmate's trying to come up with a plan, and Sugar starts rescuing other inmates.
Just saving people.
Yeah, dragging them to a floating mattress, risking her own life. She's in and out of the water, pulling people to safety.
Unbelievable.
When the water level stabilizes, she saved a bunch of people. Her cellmate makes a joke about a Jesus arc. Some of the other inmates actually thank her.
Her actions are speaking louder than words.
Then helicopters arrive. Canis forces. The lead officer sees the mess and immediately accuses Sugar of starting a riot. But then a global broadcast interrupts everything.
Kane.
Kane himself. He acknowledges the disaster, says only the strong will survive, and then the camera focuses on Sugar.
He's singling her out.
He praises her for saving the weak, for defying the flood, for surviving. The Canist officer is speechless. The prisoners start cheering, calling her queen of the wreckage. It's a total power shift.
Kane has chosen his champion.
And Sugar's in shock. But she doesn't have time to dwell on it. The sky's on fire. Tsunami sirens are blaring.
It's the apocalypse.
Sugar takes charge. She tells everyone they need to move now. And then a second impact hits, even bigger than the first.
It's getting worse.
The Canis officer's radio is warning about secondary waves, imminent submersion. Sugar rallies the prisoners, leads them through the wreckage. She helps those who can't swim, even rescues the officer who tried to arrest her.
She's a natural leader.
They reach a half-sunken transport boat. The radio says all the air units are down, wiped out by falling debris.
They're trapped.
Sugar takes the helm and aims the boat straight at a massive wave.
She's going to ride the wave.
Straight into a collapsing skyscraper.
That's insane.
They crash land on an upper floor, somehow survive. The building is unstable, about to go down.
What?
Sugar says they need to climb to the rooftop antenna, contact Kane. The other survivors think she's lost it.
I mean, it does sound crazy.
They reach the rooftop. The wind's howling. The antenna's damaged. Sugar manages to power it up, gets Kane on the line.
Direct contact with Kane.
She tells them about their situation, says it would be a shame if the future of Kaneism drowned with them. Kane seems amused by her audacity.
He likes her style.
He says he'll decide their fate. And then a cargo crate drops from the sky, lands near them. Kane says, "A gift. Use it well." And the line goes dead.
A gift? What could it be?
They open the crate, and it's just a regular cargo container with an umbrella on top.
An umbrella.
Kane comes back on the radio, says, "A house is only useful if it doesn't sink."
He's messing with them.
Sugar figures it out. They need to get the container into the water, use it as a raft. And just then, the skyscraper collapses.
In the water.
The container falls with it, but it floats.
Incredible.
Sugar looks at the umbrella like she's talking to Kane and says, "Very funny."
She's got his number.
But then they realize they're not alone. There's a crocodile in the container with them.
Oh, no.
Total chaos. Sugar yells, "What would Kane do?"
Good question.
Everyone's panicking, throwing out ideas. Sugar grabs the umbrella and starts acting like prey.
Prey.
Yeah, making weird noises, challenging the croc. And when it lunges at her, she shoves the umbrella in its mouth and opens it.
Jamming its jaws.
It's crazy. It's reckless, but it works for a second. Then the umbrella breaks.
So what do they do?
Sugar sees Kevin's wearing his usual oversized hoodie and multiple layers of shirts. She tells everyone to strip him.
I strip Kevin.
They use his clothes as rope, and after a lot of struggling, they manage to tie up the croc.
Naked Kevin and a bound crocodile. This is getting weird.
Sugar names the crocodile Coco.
Of course she does.
So they're drifting along in this container, surrounded by the apocalypse, and Sugar's thinking about her reward.
She deserves one.
Kane comes on the radio and tells her she can have anything she wants. Carte blanche.
Anything.
And Sugar doesn't hesitate. She says, "Adopt us, duh."
Adopt them.
All of them, including Coco the crocodile. And she tells Kane to call her Sugar Baby.
She's really pushing it.
Kane laughs and agrees.
He adopted a container full of misfits.
And a crocodile. So their container becomes Kane's weirdest adoption center.
Sounds about right.
A drone arrives with supplies, including chocolate. Kane tells them the real fun is about to begin.
What does that even mean?
They're Kane's wild cards now. Problem solvers, fixers, breakers. Kevin's nervous, but Sugar's thrilled.
Chaos is her element.
They get training, equipment, and they're sent out on all these missions. Infiltration, kidnapping.
Kane's personal strike team.
Coco goes with them.
Their mascot.
And then one day, Kane sends them a message. Sugar baby, he says. You might want to sit up for this one.
Yeah.
This time, it's personal.
Ominous.
Kevin's worried. Coco snorts. And Sugar. Sugar's excited. That's where we leave Sugar Cane for now.
What a journey.
From a viable baby to Cane's adopted wild card. It's really a testament to thinking differently, to defying the odds, to never giving up.
And to embracing your own weirdness.
Absolutely. Sugar's dyslexia became a strength. Her fear of water was a challenge she overcame, and she turned the apocalypse into an opportunity.
She made her own rules.
Which brings us to you, dear listener. What are your anomalies? What makes you different? And how can you turn those differences into strengths? What challenges in your life are just waiting for a little bit of Sugarcane's audacity to shake things up? What's your Sugarcane name? What do you need to embrace to conquer your own deep dives in life?